Now we're going to leave political history mostly behind for a while here and pick up the ideas of some of the great prophets. And first of all, a little something about prophecy in general, Bible prophecy. The common idea that the average person has about prophecy is that it is predicting future events. That important lady, Mrs. Jean Dixon, lives, I believe, in Washington, D.C. I wonder, would you rate her as a prophet, Mrs. Harvey? Does she claim to be? She predicts some things. Now, it's uncanny. She's predicted some things that have come true with amazing accuracy. On the other hand, their treatment of it would force us to say she's also missed the boat a number of times, too. How she does this, I don't know. A student last period says the devil helps her. She has not attempted to predict any really long-range events, as far as I know. She won't try to predict what the government of the United States will be like 700 years from now, or anything like that. She deals in the fairly near future. This is a feature of sometimes called parapsychology. That's something beyond the borderline of what ordinary psychology can explain or deal with. Now, we also have people who put on prophecies for fun. You ever get on a scale to weigh yourself and put a penny in and get a little ticket out with the prophecy about your future? On there, I read about a lady got on one, put a penny in, and the ticket came out and said, one of you will have to get off. Now, that wasn't a prophecy. That was a brief sermon. The senior class of Geneva used to get out a class prophecy every year and predict who would be the first student in that class to become a college president, who would be the first to become a noted movie star, and a number of things of this kind. They also used to have a class will. And the senior class willed me, bequeathed me a wastebasket to trip over, very nice of them. And the education department, don't tell it outside this room, but senior class willed the education department a roulette wheel to decide who gets the grade. Please note, I don't think this is the education department. I'm only telling you what the senior class said. And this is only fun, of course. I don't suppose there was anybody in that class that really took it seriously. They had class day, and this was read, and it's supposed to be comic and fun. Now, we have in the Bible, however, what claims to be real prophecy and real prophets. And the ordinary idea that most people have, you say prophet, what is a prophet? They'll say, a prophet is a man who knew how to foretell or predict the future. And this is not completely wrong, of course. The prophets did foretell things. This man Isaiah that we pick up today predicted many things about Jesus Christ, which came through 700 years later. So foretelling the future or predicting future outcomes and future events was certainly a crucial part and a very important part of the work of the prophet. However, the word prophet does not mean a predictor of the future. This comes from two Greek words, pro and phemi. It means to speak for someone. Back there when God called Moses to lead the people of Israel out of Egypt. You remember that from last semester, I hope. And remember, Moses didn't feel he could do it. He had a whole collection of excuses and alibis why he couldn't do this job. And among others, he said he never was any good at public speaking and couldn't make a speech. And the Lord said to Moses, Aaron, your brother is good at speaking. He can go and do the speaking, and you can tell him what to say. And you can be as God to Aaron, and he can be your prophet. Now you see, here the message comes from Moses through Aaron to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, or to the Israelite people sometimes. This is the work of a prophet. He speaks for someone, and a true prophet speaks for God. So it starts with God, comes down to the level of the prophet. He gets a revelation or a message in some way, and they had many ways of getting it. And then, in turn, he tells it to people, either to some particular person or to a whole group of people or maybe a whole country. But from God, through the prophet, to man or to the people. This is the converse or reverse of the function of a priest in the Old Testament system. The prophet moves from God down to the prophet to the people. The priest is the opposite way. Starts with the sin of the human. The priest represents a sinful human in offering a sacrifice and praying for his forgiveness and reconciling him to God. So in the case of the priest, the direction of action is the sinner through the priest to God. But in the case of the prophet, it is God through the prophet to the people. Now, they had true prophets that were really called by God to be prophets. And Isaiah, of course, one of these. They also had prophets who claimed to speak for the true God, but God had not sent them. These men may have been mere pretenders sometimes, or they may have been sincere but mistaken, sort of self-deceived or self-hypnotized into thinking that God had sent them, but really he hadn't. But still, they claimed to speak for the true God, not for any false God. And then a third category, those of you that read Edward J. Young's little book, To My Servants the Prophets, of course you know all this already, but the third category, those who claim to speak for other gods, like the prophets of Baal that Elijah had something to do with. So you see here, true prophets of the true God whom God has called. These are the real thing. Secondly, there are prophets who claim to speak for the true God, but God has not called them. And in their messages, there was an element of falsehood mixed in. And then thirdly, prophets who didn't even claim to speak for the true God, they claimed to speak for some other God, such as Baal or whoever it was. Now then, we're dealing, of course, here in Hebrew prophecy with the true prophet, such as Isaiah. Who is the first of the prophets in Old Testament history? Well, Mr. Young, Moses is called a prophet, and certainly, strictly speaking, we'll have to rate him as the first of the prophets. Samuel, all right. Now, Moses is so much more than a prophet. He is a unique figure, combining many functions, and he's a lawgiver, a diplomat, a military leader, poet, and so forth. So, usually he's not counted as the first of the prophets, although he certainly was one. But Samuel is traditionally spoken of as the first of a line of prophets, and then we have a whole succession following him. Now, we've met up with a number of them in this course. Samuel, Ahijah, who ripped his robe into 12 parts and told Jeroboam to pick up 10 of them. Nathan, who told David he had committed a sin. Elijah and Elisha, who were at the time of the Baal crisis of Ahab and so forth. Micaiah, who told Ahab not to go to Ramoth Gilead and he'd be killed if he did, and some others. These men did not write books that go by their names. What we know about them, we get out of the historical books of the Old Testament, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles. It is possible that Samuel wrote the bulk of those two books called Books of Samuel, although they don't claim that he did. And certainly he didn't write the part that happened after his death. But anyway, these early prophets did not write books. They delivered their messages, and what we know about them is incidentally recorded, woven into the historical narrative. Then we come to 700 BC, and here the prophets begin to write books. So they not only, let's say, get a message from God, which they in turn pass on to the people, but they commit it to writing so that future generations can have it. You remember we had the account of how Jehoiakim burned the roll of the written prophecies of Jeremiah, the writing prophecies. And these start here with Isaiah and others of his time in the 700s B.C. or the 8th century. Of these prophets, there are four that are commonly rated major prophets. And there they are up on the blackboard: Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. And this is put up here to show you the sequence of these men. They didn't live at the same time. Isaiah in the 700s B.C., latter part of the 700s, Jeremiah in the 600s B.C. and down into the 500s, and these other two, Ezekiel and Daniel, in the middle of the 500s. Now, you realize, of course, each of these men had a long career, 50 years more or less, so you can't put up a single figure for their date. But this is near enough to get the order and sequence of these men: Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. They are called major prophets, not necessarily because they are the most important of the prophets, but because their books are longer. Daniel might seem to be an exception to this. It only has 12 chapters, but anyhow, he's called one major prophet, maybe because of some of the contents of his book. But these are the writing prophets, major prophets, followed by the minor prophets: Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, and so forth, down to Malachi, 12 of them. And most of their books are quite short, in some cases less than a single page in the Bible. So the major prophets and the minor prophets, and these men wrote books so that we have their prophecies or the substance of them, the part that was intended to be of permanent importance and value, down in written form. Now, a prophet had to be called by God. If he didn't or wasn't called by God, he is presuming something and is taking advantage of people's gullibility and is really deceiving people. And we have the record of how Isaiah was called by God in the 6th chapter of his book. He tells how he got a call from God to be a prophet. Isaiah chapter 6, and maybe we should notice these comments here, this description a little bit. In the year that King Uzziah died, remember this man Uzziah? He was counted one of the good kings, but he was the one that made one bad break. He tried to horn into the high priest's office and burn incense in the temple. And for this he was smitten with leprosy, and quarantined off by himself for the rest of his life. That was Uzziah. However, on the whole, he is rated as among the best, except for this one mistake or sin that he did. And evidently, Isaiah thought a great deal of this man. He takes his call to be a prophet from the time when King Uzziah died. It seems that the death of Uzziah made a deep impression on him, and when Uzziah went out of his life, God came in a new and vital way. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw also the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. This is a vision of the glory of God in the Jerusalem temple, and it speaks of the seraphim. This Bible I have here says seraphim. This is redundant and unnecessary plural. Seraph is the singular, a C-R-A-P-H, kind of angel. Seraph is the singular. Seraphim is the plural, masculine noun, ethnic, the plural in Hebrew by adding I-M, and a feminine noun adds E-T-H or O-T-H. Seraphim. That means two or more. You wouldn't say mouse, mice, mices. One mouse, two mice, three mice. This would be a superfluous plural, and I don't know why the King James translators, who certainly knew the Hebrew, did this, but here it says seraphim. It should be seraphim or the seraphs. Each of these has six wings, two to cover his face, two to cover his feet, and with two to fly in the service of God. And one cried to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And the posts of the door moved at the voice of him that cried, and the house was filled with smoke, like an earthquake shock. Then said I, woe is me, for I am undone, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips, for mine eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. This is the reaction of a godly man who gets a new vision of the glory of God. He immediately feels his own sinfulness and unworthiness. Now, Peter, in the New Testament, after the miraculous catch of fish on the Sea of Galilee, the disciples had fished all night and hadn't gotten a thing, and Jesus said, let the net down on the right side of the ship, and they drew it up and had, I believe, 153 fish caught in that net. Peter said to Jesus, depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord. Not that Peter really wanted Jesus to go away and never come back into his life, but it's an instinctive reaction to the majesty and the power and the holiness of the Lord. This is what Isaiah said when he got this vision of the glory of God. Now, let me add that we are not to compare ourselves with our neighbors. A student said to Reverend Willard McMillan, if God grades on the curve, I've got it made. You see, I'm among the 10% of best Christians in the freshman class. Therefore, I'm going to heaven. Well, don't worry, God doesn't grade on the curve. And I suppose Isaiah, if he'd have said, well, look here, among the inhabitants of my suburb of Jerusalem, I'm among the top 10. I've got it made. But no, when he got a vision of the glory of God, he fell way, way down. His sinfulness. I'm a man of unclean lips. And this is how we are to really rate ourselves. You read the Bible and see what it says about the holiness of God, and you won't feel so good and so righteous maybe as you felt before. Incidentally, it was good and necessary that Isaiah feel this way. Suppose when he had seen this vision, he'd have said, Lord, you sure picked the right man to be a prophet. I'm one of the most religious men in Jerusalem. This would have indicated a bad and a wrong attitude. His attitude showed that he put his faith in God, not in himself as a good person, but his faith in God. And if you are a Christian and going to heaven, let me tell you, this is not because you are good, because God is good, not because you are good. We do not have the kind of goodness just of ourselves that it takes to do that, and God does not grade on the curve. He grades on the absolute percentage. And what God does, he grades on the absolute percentage. Every one of us would be a low F. But he looks at Jesus Christ, and the grade that Jesus gets is counted to us. Christianity involves not lowering the standard, but substituting the person who complies with the standard. So if Jesus Christ rates the top A, this is how you and I, who believe on him, can get into heaven. Now then, he said, I'm a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. I'm not clean, I'm not holy. And one of these seraphim, or seraphs, in the vision, took a piece of red-hot charcoal and touched his lips, and said, this has touched your lips, your sin is cleansed away. Then he heard the voice of God saying, whom shall I send, and who will go for us? And he replied, here am I, send me. So God has called him, and he has received and accepted this call to be a prophet. Now in the verses that follow, in chapter 6, verses 9 to 13, he is told that he is to go, and what he is to do, and God will be with him and give him the message to speak. But he is also told in advance that the majority will not accept it. This is a heartbreak, you know, that he will not be accepted or believed by the majority. Only the minority will accept his message, and this minority is compared here to 10%, one-tenth, that will receive it and will profit by it and get the real benefit from it. Now then, this is the call of Isaiah, the be a prophet, and he had a long career, 40 to 50 years or more, over 50 years, I guess we could say, as a prophet. A little something now about the literary unity of this book. And first of all, this book is full of predictions of our Savior, Jesus Christ. It has been called the fifth gospel, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Isaiah. I read an account, and I think it was a true one, of a Christian worker in Europe somewhere who was working among Jewish people, trying to win an elderly Jew to be a Christian. And they were sitting in a room and talking, and this Christian worker said, I'm going to read you something. So he started to read, and he read to him. When he got through, he said, do you recognize what I read? Yes. What was it? Gospel of St. Matthew. And this missionary said, there's where you're mistaken. What I read to you was the 53rd chapter of Isaiah, part of your Jewish scriptures. This man hadn't recognized it. Now, 53rd chapter of Isaiah certainly speaks of Jesus Christ. The book of Isaiah is quoted more times in the New Testament than any other Old Testament book except the book of Psalms, and that isn't a fair comparison because the book of Psalms is much longer than the book of Isaiah. So, quoted over and over again in the New Testament as fulfilled in the life and career and death and so forth and resurrection of Jesus Christ. You know, many Jews today are secular, not religious. They're Jewish by descent, like you might be Irish or French or whatever, but they're not religious. But if you ask a religious Jew who claims to be faithful to the Jewish religious heritage, who is the servant of the Lord in Isaiah chapter 53, I will guarantee you'll get one of three answers. Either he will say, I don't know. This, of course, may be quite correct. I don't know. Or he will say, the servant of the Lord that went as a lamb to the slaughter and so on is King Hezekiah, that good king who suffered so much for his people during the Assyrian crisis. Incidentally, there are things in Isaiah 53 that certainly don't fit anything known about the career of King Hezekiah, but that's what they'll tell you, King Hezekiah. And the third answer, and this is the one you're most likely to get at the present day, is that the servant of the Lord in Isaiah chapter 53 is not an individual person at all, but this is a collective personality and stands for the Jews or the people of Israel taken all together as a body of people, that the Jews have suffered and yet have brought a benefit to the world, and that the servant of the Lord in Isaiah 53 is the Jewish people taken collectively. Now, we'll take that chapter up later in another day when we have messianic prophecies. But just by the way, while we're on it here, the New Testament quotes it as fulfilled in an individual person, Jesus Christ, and it quotes it many times as fulfilled in Jesus Christ. So it does refer to an individual person. Now then, this long book has been pretty generally kicked around by modern critical scholars. It is generally admitted that Isaiah wrote the first 39 chapters of this book. There's a trace or two in there that the question raised about, but pretty generally admitted that Isaiah wrote the first 39 chapters. But chapters 40 to 66, it is widely held that he couldn't have written them, and that they were written by somebody else long afterwards. My telephone rang one night, and I answered it, and a lady's voice came over the wire and said, what's all this stuff about the second Isaiah? I said, what stuff about the second Isaiah? Well, this Sunday school quarterly they gave me to teach my junior high class is full of it, the second Isaiah. What's it about anyhow? Why do they call him the second Isaiah? I said, you asking me why they call him the second Isaiah? Yeah. All right. Because they don't know what his real name was. Why don't they know what his real name was? I said, well, if you're asking me, the reason they don't know what his real name was is he never lived. Well, then she wanted to know why they talked about the second Isaiah, and I told her a little bit about it, and lent her a book to read, Edward J. Young's little book, We Wrote Isaiah. And she said, "Well, I do declare, I'm going to see to it that my class gets this straight. Second Isaiah." Now, modern scholarship, with quotes around that word modern, quote unquote, holds that Isaiah couldn't have written the whole of this book, but that it was written by at least two men, maybe three or even more. The simplest of these theories is that from chapter 40 to 66 was written by a Mr. X, the unknown second Isaiah, about 150 years after the first Isaiah lived. Further refinement of this theory is that the closing half dozen or so chapters were written by another unknown, the third Isaiah. Now let me tell you, neither the second Isaiah nor the third Isaiah is known to history. They not only don't know their names, there's no evidence whatever that either of these men ever lived. They're purely hypothetical characters. On the other hand, these critical scholars who say Isaiah couldn't have written the whole book are not fools, neither are they crazy men. They are learned scholars and they have reasons for what they say. And where they get off the boat and believe differently from us is in their basic approach or assumptions. If we believe the same as they do about God and the way God reveals himself and so on, their basic philosophy of religion, if we shared their philosophy of religion, we would have to say as they do, Isaiah said in the written. Anybody that holds the basic approach of these modern scholars will have to agree with their conclusions that Isaiah couldn't have written it. They point out the fact that these chapters show a scene and events that really happened 150 to 200 years after the time of Isaiah. And since these men do not believe that God could foretell the future, at least not over 100 years, he couldn't. Therefore, when what seems to be a prophecy is found, it must have been written after the things happened, or at any rate, while they were happening. So they hold that this must have been ghostwritten by somebody else long afterwards. Now then, Khrushchev, the former dictator of Soviet Russia, at the UN, I believe, in New York, took his shoe off and held it and pounded the podium with the heel. Most unconventional diplomatic gimmick, but anyhow, that's Khrushchev, and said, "West Berlin is a bone that sticks in my throat." Now, why would the dictator of Soviet Russia say that West Berlin was a bone that stuck in his throat? And what did he mean? Mr. Spenderman, what do you suppose he meant by that? Well, he was real generous with Khrushchev, everybody's conscience, we hope. Look, West Berlin is buzzing with prosperity and life and activity. And East Berlin in the communist zone is a drab and sad place compared with West Berlin. People in East Berlin risk their life to get to West Berlin. Somebody said they vote with their feet. I heard a joke about a, told by a professor of education, so I guess it's all right to tell him that, a dog that escaped from East Berlin to West Berlin. Somehow he made it to cross that wall. And the other dog met up with him near a fire hydrant or some other rendezvous and began asking him questions. "Why did you leave East Berlin? Didn't you like it there?" "Oh, it's all right, I guess." "Didn't you have food to eat?" "Sure, I had food to eat." "Had a place to sleep?" "Yeah, I had a place to sleep. On the cellar stairs." "Well, why did you leave East Berlin?" "If you must know, I wanted to bark." Now, East Berlin lacks that human freedom that makes life worth living, you see. And West Berlin has it as part of the free world. So West Berlin is a constant advertisement to all and sundry that communism is more or less of an economic failure. And dirty capitalism produces a better life with more things and more prosperity and so forth. And so So we got to get rid of West Berlin, get it down to the same grab level as East Berlin. So it was a bone that stuck in Khrushchev's throat. Now there's a prophecy in Isaiah that sticks in the throat of these critics. And it's in the end of chapter 44 and the beginning of chapter 45. And this I'll explain to you. In the first place, the real Isaiah lived in the 700s. What country was the real military power and menace and threat to the Jews at that time, in 700? Assyria, sure. And Babylon? Babylon was just a pawn on the chessboard in the 700s B.C. It was there, of course. There was such a place, and it had people in it, and it was a big city and a country around it. But Babylon was no great shakes in the 700s B.C. Assyria was the power. And Babylon was just one of the countries that was under their thumb. Now then, that's in the 700s. You look in the latter part of the book of Isaiah, and you see Babylon is the great power. And the scene pictured is that near the end of the power of Babylon, when Babylon itself is about to be overthrown. In Isaiah's day, Babylon hadn't even started to be important. And yet the second part of Isaiah pictures Babylon as a country that has been great, and is now about to disappear and be conquered by yet a third power. Therefore, the scene pictured here is that of the Babylonian captivity of the Jews and near the end of it. It predicts the end of the captivity, whereas in Isaiah's day, even the beginning of it hadn't happened yet, and didn't for 100 years later. Now then, it predicts here that the Jewish captivity in Babylon will be ended by a king named Cyrus, who will turn the green light on for the Jews to go free. This Cyrus is known to history, of course. He was a Persian king. All right, Isaiah 44, and we'll read a few verses here. Thus saith, verse 24, thus saith the Lord, thy Redeemer, he that formed thee from the womb. I am the Lord that maketh all things, that stretcheth forth the heavens alone, that spreadeth abroad the earth by myself, that frustrateth the tokens of the liar. Those are the false prophets. That maketh diviners mad. Those are the fortune tellers. God turns them crazy. That turneth wise men backward and maketh their knowledge foolish. That confirmeth the word of his servant and performeth the counsel of his messengers. That saith to Jerusalem, thou shalt be inhabited, and to the cities of Judah ye shall be built. In Isaiah's day, they hadn't even been destroyed yet. Now it's predicted they'll be rebuilt. That saith to the deep, be dry, and I will dry up thy rivers. That saith of Cyrus, he is my shepherd, and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, thou shalt be built, and to the temple thy foundation shall be laid. In Isaiah's day, it hadn't been destroyed yet. And here it's predicted it will be rebuilt at a new foundation laid. Well, 45. Thus saith the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden to subdue nations before him. The Persian Empire, he became the great new power. And I will loose the loins of kings to open before him the two-leaved gates, that's of the city of Babylon, and the gates shall not be shut. I will go before thee and make the crooked places straight, and I will break in pieces the gates of brass and cut in sunder the bars of iron. And I will give thee, that give Cyrus, the treasures of darkness and hidden riches of secret places, that thou mayest know that I, the Lord, which call thee by thy name, see, that name is Cyrus, call thee by thy name, am the God of Israel. For Jacob thy servant's sake, and Israel mine elect, I have even called thee by thy name. I have surnamed thee, though thou hast not known me. Now these modern scholars say, quit your kidding. Isaiah could have figured out maybe what would happen in 3 years or 5 years by doping it out and analyzing the trends, but 150 to 200 years, oh, come on now. He couldn't possibly have predicted that. And to predict by name the Persian king, when Persia hadn't even started to be great yet, the Persian king that would let the Jews go free and go back to their own country if they wanted to, Come on now, he couldn't have done it. Now, of course, Isaiah couldn't have done it if it's human guesswork like the Gallup poll. Who's going to be the next president of the United States? Mr. Goodman, you know? Well, some say Muskie, some say Nixon, and some say Mayor Flaherty will be the next president. I don't know. And nobody knows. The Gallup poll predicted once that Adlai Stevenson would be elected on the basis of their sampling of opinion all over the country. And the day after the voting was done, it turned out Dwight Eisenhower was elected. The Gallup poll was wrong. George Gallup had a red face that day. He admitted they had goofed it up and said they would improve and refine their method of sampling public opinion to get it right the next time. But they predicted Stevenson would win and Eisenhower won the election and became the next president. Now, nobody could possibly foretell who will be the next president of the United States. Several people had hoped they will be, but who would dare to say for sure? History might prove them wrong. And you see, the modern idea of these prophets is that they were trend analysts. They were intellectuals, something like our people that write commentaries and columns, David Warren or Andrew Tully, that write the comments in the paper, sort of trying to analyze what's going on, current events, and interpret it and give you the meaning of it on a basis of this, make a few short-range predictions. Somebody predicts that judging from the statements of many senators and congressmen, it is quite likely that the universal service draft law will be repealed within 1 year from now. I would be very glad if it is. But at any rate, this is a sort of a, let's say, educated guesswork based upon sampling of opinions and trends and little straws that show how the wind's blowing. But still, it's just the human intellect. And people that believe that way about these prophets, they put them down alongside of the Greek philosophers. These men are basically thinkers or intellectuals. Now then, according to the Bible, that isn't so at all. These men got their stuff from God. And if God doesn't know the future, he isn't God. A God that has to find out the future from day to day isn't God. I read about a minister on the West Coast wrote a book explaining Bible prophecies, and he predicted certain things about Soviet Russia and Germany some years ago. And he claimed that he found these two and identified them and how it was going to work out. And then one morning he came down to breakfast and looked at his morning newspaper, and it had turned out very differently from what he had predicted. And he looked at the paper, a good hard look, and then looked up toward the sky and said, "Lord, you've double-crossed me." Now, he was claiming to figure it out, of course, and got it wrong. The prophets were not intellectuals. They were organs of divine revelation. And if the future is not already known to God in detail and with certainty, predictive prophecy, of course, would be impossible. Now, the modern idea of prophecy is that it's a product of the thinking of the prophet. I read a book on the Old Testament by a man named Bright. His name was Bright, and he was Bright. But he wasn't very orthodox. John Bright, Richmond, Virginia, professor of Old Testament studies in a theological school. All the way through this book, he uses this kind of language. Isaiah felt that certain things would happen. Jeremiah realized that the outcome of this could only be such and such. Amos was convinced that such and such must be wrong, that such and such must be right. So-and-so discerned the trend of the times. And all of this kind of language implying, of course, that the prophets were primarily thinkers and doped it out. Now, according to the Bible, in 1 Peter it is, 2 Peter rather, Peter's second epistle, chapter 1, verse 21, the Apostle Peter says, "No prophecy ever came by the will of man, but holy men of God spoke. spoke as they were moved by the Holy Spirit. And the Greek word moved, paramenoi, is carried along. As they were carried along by the Holy Spirit. So it didn't start with the prophets, it came from God. The message comes through the prophet to people, but it started from God. And that, of course, is a very different thing. Now then, another thing about this theory that Isaiah was written 150 years later, the second part of it was written by somebody else, that is very strange. You read Isaiah chapters 40 to 66, and the human events and the human scene in there, undoubtedly and beyond any question, is that of the latter part of the Babylonian captivity. It fits perfectly. But the natural scenery is that of Palestine, where the prophet Isaiah had lived. Now, Babylonia is pancake flat. It's an alluvial plain of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers as they run out to the sea, the last little stretch of it. No mountains. Very few trees. You read the latter chapters of Isaiah. While the human scene is that of the Babylonian captivity as it comes to its end, the natural scenery is that of Palestine, the hills, the mountains, the trees, the birds, the running brooks, the waterfalls, the sheep and the goats grazing on the mountains, the flowers and the plants. Everything fits Palestine and doesn't fit Babylon. That's a strange fact. If the real Isaiah wrote it, you see, God revealed to him these future events, and this went through his mind, and the, let's say, stage scenery of the prophecy, the mountains and the hills and the waterfalls and all these things, were things that he knew and that he was familiar with from having lived among them and having seen them. So this would explain it. On the other hand, if you believe in the modern way, that the latter part of Isaiah was ghostwritten after the things had happened, and Cyrus is mentioned because he was already in the headlines. If they'd had newspapers, he would have been. Then how do you explain the fact that the natural scenery in the so-called second part of Isaiah is that of Palestine and not that of Babylonia? This is a bone that can stick in our throat a little bit about that. All right, now, people will tell you that all scholars are agreed that Isaiah was written by at least two different men, maybe more likely three. This, please note, is not true. It is only scholars who hold the modern critical viewpoint that are agreed on this. There are plenty of men. This is not a question of scholarship, it's a question of where do you stand. Scholars, there are plenty of them, who have PhD degrees from the world's greatest universities, who believe that Isaiah wrote the whole book. Dr. Edward J. Young is one, but there are plenty of others like this. And, well, did I tell you in this class about one of my professors, Robert Dick Wilson, and what he said? Robert Dick Wilson is dead now. He had one bad habit. He smoked cigars at 2 o'clock in the morning while he was poring over Assyrian texts. All the same, I think he's gone to heaven. Pretty sure of it. But anyhow, Robert Dick Wilson knew 35 languages. He set himself to defend the genuineness of the Old Testament and learned every language that any part of the Old Testament had been translated into, or any part of the Bible, down to 500 AD. 35 languages. If you read anybody that knew 35 languages, had a reading knowledge of them as a scholar, well, I sure would. He was quite famous, Robert Dick Wilson, came from Western Pennsylvania. His home was in Catanix. He taught in Princeton Theological Seminary in its best days. And a very eccentric old fellow. We had Hebrew classes in his study and funeral-type chairs, and his filing system was to stack stuff around the room in piles, such as in the papers. Nobody, not even his wife, was allowed to touch any of them, and for years that place didn't get a real thorough cleaning. He knew exactly where to find everything. Came to class one day in January with a straw hat on. Another time his suspenders broke in class, and the pants began to get lowered, and he got him up again under control and said, well, gentlemen, it's a good thing there are no ladies present. But he was famous for some of his things. One thing he said was, no man living knows enough to disprove the truth of any single statement in the Old Testament. Another time, remember, gentlemen, opinion is not proof. This was Robert Dick Wilson. He was billed to speak at a summer conference of missionaries in China at a place called Kuling, where a lot of them used to go for meetings in summertime. And they found out he was going to speak on the scholarly defense of the Old Testament. And they canceled the billing. And Wilson went there anyhow. But why did you cancel my lecture? Well, it's controversial and will disturb fellowship, the scholarly defense of the Old Testament. At this, Wilson blew up. All right. If the scholarly defense of God's holy word is a controversial subject and cannot be discussed in your auditorium, I will go out and deliver my lecture under God's sky. And those that want to hear me can come and hear me. And when they found out he was going to do it anyhow, why, they put him on after all. Now, Robert Dick Wilson, a liberal professor, said about this, he said, all scholars are agreed that Isaiah couldn't have written the whole book. And somebody asked this problem, don't you consider Robert Dick Wilson a scholar? Who? Robert Dick Wilson. Oh, yes, I know who you mean. I'll tell you about him. Robert Dick Wilson could be a scholar. He knows enough to be a scholar, but unfortunately the man has identified himself with a position which it is impossible for a scholar to hold. Now you see, he agrees with me, he's a scholar. If he doesn't agree with me, he's a nut. Is this what we call scholarship? That is the most bigoted, narrow-minded kind of a provincial statement that anybody could make. Somebody with a PhD from one of the world's great universities is a scholar, whether I like him or not, and whether he agrees with me or not. Now, don't let anybody blow you down. There's plenty of scholarship back of the traditional belief that Isaiah wrote the whole book, and it has not been disproved. The reason these critics say he couldn't have written it is not because of the argument, but because of their starting point. They're putting horse meat in the sausage machine, and of course that's what comes out too.